dollar.
The Capital Investment Committee will come to order. First item that we're going to take on the agenda today is the report about the sports center. Mr. Johnson, this is such fun. Mr. Johnson started as a page.
You're right.
With the House of Representatives. It seems like just yesterday, but apparently it was a long time ago.
Yes, it was, Madam Speaker.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you very much.
And you're the director?
I am the executive director, yes.
Very good. And how long has that been?
Just about 4 years now.
Holy cow, where have I been?
Right here.
Just in right other here. Committees.
That's right, other committees, right? That's right.
Thank you so much. This is just such fun that you're back.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Madam Speaker, members of the committee, my name is Todd Johnson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. By running the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, that means I also run the National Sports Center Foundation. With me today is one of our my colleagues, Ryan Heverin, who I'll reference a little bit in my testimony. And I've been told by Jenny to keep it tight, so we'll get you out of here in 5 minutes, okay? Or I'll get out of here in 5 minutes. So it was February, about a year ago, February 21st, 2018, in South Korea. Afton, Minnesota's Jesse Diggins unleashed her torrid come-from-behind sprint, passing the world's top sprinter, Stina Nelson of Sweden, and the USA won the Olympic gold medal in a women's cross-country ski team sprint. It was the first U.S. first Olympic gold medal in cross-country skiing ever. The next day, February 22nd, across town in Korea, Maddie Rooney, a Duluth-born and an Andover High School grad, stands in the goal for Team USA in their gold medal women's hockey final against Canada. With the score tied 2-2, after regulation and overtime, it goes to a shootout. In the sixth round of the shootout, Rooney stops Canada's top female player, Megan Agosta, and the USA wins the gold medal, their first Olympic gold since 1998, ending Canada's streak of four consecutive Olympic championships. Watching from behind the glass that night was Ryan Heverin from Coon Rapids. He had been selected as one of the ice technicians at the Olympics, which is a great honor to be in charge of the ice for the Olympic Games. These are great and inspirational Minnesota stories, to be sure, but what did they have in common? All of these Olympic heroes competed and learned their trade at sports facilities financed by the state of Minnesota capital bonding dollars. In grants administered by the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, Diggins skied at Giants Ridge in Biwabik, Rooney skated at the Super Rink in Blaine, where Heverin learned to drive the Zamboni from his father. The Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission was created in 1987 by the Minnesota Legislature to promote the economic and social benefits of sports. The MASC was one of the first sports commissions in the United States, and Minnesota's realization for the potential for sports tourism was, at the time, very innovative. As the chair knows, Governor Perpich stuck his neck out to get this facility built. At the time, he was even coined as Governor Goofy, but the facility now in Blaine has 4.2 million visitors a year. 2.1 of them go to our ice rinks. Now, around the country, sports commissions abound, and there's a considerable amount of competition for the sports dollar, primarily in the youth sports market. Many communities are developing new and elaborate sports facilities. The youth sports market is currently a $15 billion business annually and has grown 55% since 2010. This industry is projected to be over $40 billion annually in the next 5 years. The Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission is best known for three things: its governance of the National Sports Center in Blaine, creating amateur sports events at all of our facilities to attract out-of-state visitors, which generate economic impact for the state. Many of these events are held at the NSC, where the USA Cup soccer tournament in July being the most notable. It's the third largest youth soccer tournament in the world. Last year we had nearly 1,200 teams from 20 countries and 20 states. Thirdly, fostering public and private state-local partnerships, most notably through the administration of innovative and progressive grant programs like the James Metzen Mighty Ducks Grant Program and the Hennepin County Youth Sports Program. Through state bonding paired with local non-state funding sources, the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission has built 12 sports facilities around the state that generate sports tourism dollars for their local economies and provide training and learning venues for young Minnesota athletes hoping to fulfill their Olympic dreams and follow in the footsteps of Jesse Diggins and Maddie Rooney. Cross-country skiers take to the snow at Giants Ridge and Biwabik. Volleyball hopefuls play at the National Volleyball Center in Rochester. Speed skaters master their crossovers at the Roseville Oval. Ski jumpers fly at the Bush Lake Jump in Bloomington. Future soccer stars take to the massive 50-field complex at the National Sports Center in Blaine. And even entry-level Zamboni drivers learn their trade at the Super Rink at the NSC. Thank you very much. There is a handout, if there were any questions. What I did with the handout was to try to show where the grants through the Mighty Ducks program and through the Hennepin County Grants program have been distributed. And on the back side was just to encapsulate the USA Cup dollars from last year. As you can see, the amount of economic growth or economic impact from those events is pretty astounding. And believe me, those are very conservative numbers. I never want to overestimate them. Those are only out-of-state money, so those do not include teams that stay at hotels from Minnesota. So it's all out-of-state money.
And Mr. Johnson, can you comment on the international aspect?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, members of the committee. At the time, Governor Perpich had returned from Vienna, and he was trying to figure out ways to capture this international piece. So USA Cup is probably our biggest flagship for that. Like I said, there were 20 countries last year from 20 different states. But any time during the year, we have teams from Norway, from Sweden. In a week, we're going to have the women or the girls Chinese team coming to train at our facility for 2 weeks. So that particular aim and goal has been fulfilled and continues to be an important outreach for us to do.
And do you work with the Sister City program at all?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, wherever possible, we try to figure out ways to get teams from other states and from other countries. As a matter of fact, we do use any program like that. As a matter of fact, we just last week announced that we've got our 50th state now coming to the USA Cup. We had, for some reason, we were not able to get a team from Rhode Island through the 35 years of USA Cup, and we got one last week, so we can now brag that we've had all 50 states come or will have come to the USA Cup in Blaine.
Mr. Hebron, tell us about your apprenticeship program.
Excuse me.
Just say Madam Speaker.
Oh, Madam Speaker.
Yep.
My name is Ryan Hebron.
Yes. I'm the speaker.
Let's not go too far.
My name is Ryan Hebron. I started at the Swan Super Rink at the National Sports Center when I was 18 years old, and I learned how to drive Zamboni from my father, Daniel Hebron, who had ran an ice rink for 27 years previously. I really didn't know what I wanted.
This place
at the National Sports Center.
Okay. But you were 18.
I was 18 years old, fresh out of high school.
I had visions of you as 5-year-old driving the Zamboni.
There are pictures
of. Thank you for correcting me.
Sorry. There are pictures of me actually riding on the Zamboni when I was a little kid.
But riding it, not driving.
Yeah, not driving it. No. Yes. None of that. So.
I'm glad we were able to clarify that. And so, what's happened since you were 18?
So, I've learned a lot of very important things, and I've had a lot of great people help me along the way on my path to. From just being an 18-year-old part-time Zamboni driver, mopping the bleachers and cleaning toilets and just making ice, to getting a job at the Xcel Energy Center when I was 22 years old, and then ultimately when I was 26 being invited to the 2018 Korean Winter Olympics.
To drive the Zamboni
for the hockey games in Gangwon Hockey Center.
Is there a competitive
Sorry, what was that?
Is there a competitive action that you have to do to get invited to be the Zamboni person at something that
So the XL Energy Center has one of the better crews in the NHL, and the Olympic Committee actually reached out to us and had recommended that, you know, send a few drivers from our crew, and I was lucky enough to be one of the drivers that got to go out to work the Olympics.
And so you could train Minnesota Zamboni drivers all around the state, and then they could get to apply for something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I really hope someone I train gets to do something as great as that someday.
Well, I think so. I think that this is just great. And here we have two experts in the world on running centers and competitions, and you started as a young person and going into maturity, and what an impact for the state to have you as our leaders. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ryan tells a story, and he may be too shy to say it, but he actually learned to drive the Zamboni on Rink 6, and those of you who've been to the Sports Center realize, probably know that that's where the U.S. Olympic women's team trains. So he learned to train there, and then I overheard him on a public radio story out of Los Angeles during the Olympics say, how would you like to be the guy who got to learn to drive the Zamboni where the team trains, and then I got the Zamboni up their tiers after they won the gold medal.
Nice.
Wonderful. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Mr. Johnson, I want to thank you for mentioning my constituent, Jessie Diggins, and her gold medal win. And I also would like to remind people that Minnesota was awarded the 2020 World Ski Cup Championships. And so I know that you were involved with that, Mr. Johnson. I appreciate that help. And just one last thing, if anybody wants to relive the final kick of Jessie Diggins' race, I can guarantee if you go to YouTube to watch that and you hear the final call of Here Comes Diggins, you'll get chills down your back.
Pretty inspiring. Thank you very much.
And she visited our area in the fall, and hundreds of people turned up to see her. It was such fun. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last couple of years I've been lucky enough to serve on the Amateur Sports Commission, and one of the neat things that he didn't mention, I just think, is, you know, soccer is really coming, you know, right down the road here. The new stadium's coming. But maybe you want to speak of what you were able to get a commitment from the team to train up in Blaine for quite a few years. And, I mean, it's a major commitment. So for the kids to see the professionals and the interaction, and the team is really helping youth, and you've started that school, you're going to start a school up there as well for sports, and anyways, there's other stuff that, but just tell, if it's okay with the chair, if you could just give like a few seconds on the commitment from the soccer team to Minnesota long into the future. So congratulations for that. I was really impressed.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, thank you for the question. Yes, when I first started, remember, I'm only the second person to have the honor of running this facility. Paulie Erickson ran the National Sports Center and the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission for 30 years before I got there. Job number one was to make sure that Minnesota United, the soccer team, stayed and continued to train at the Sports Center. If you look at what's going on with the arms race and professional sports, these teams are lured by cities to go and build sports training facilities with all kinds of riches. We didn't have many riches to offer. However, the ownership group clearly understood the benefit of being at the world's largest soccer facility. They understood the importance, what that would mean. I can only contrast it to a couple of sites that I visited, namely Atlanta, where they built a $65 million training facility outside of Atlanta, which is a gated facility with a guard, as opposed to Minnesota United. We've signed a 35-year deal. They are going to stay at the Sports Center for the contract mirrors the contract at Allianz Stadium. They've decided to stay there. The local boys and girls have access to observe their training, and their facilities are right there, front and center. So it's a completely different feel than other professional other professional sports for training. Obviously, they go away for private sessions, and you're not have total access, but there's plenty of access, and boy, the kids really like it. Matter of fact, we've got the sports center wide open right now for the last 3 days with the sub-zero temperatures. We've opened up all three of our venues. We have ice rinks open. We have the 60,000 square foot indoor soccer facility, and we have our basketball courts open. So kids in the neighborhood are up there using it. Starting at 10 o'clock today again.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, thank you for providing this information for us. And what I'm going to ask you, just wanted to see if you have any information on where our participating athletes are coming from. And if you have that, please share with us after the meeting. That's fine. And where I'm trying to go is trying to figure out, is there a cost for our athletes to use some of these facilities, and if there is, what are you doing to ensure that cost is not a barrier for some of our constituents from accessing some of these state resources?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, great question, and I'd be happy to provide the specifics to you. I grew up on the Iron Range and in western Minnesota. My father was a public school superintendent, last of 8 kids. I understand the importance of access and the ability for people to come and access these venues. We're not a facility where you have to pay $5 for a bottle of water intentionally. We try to make all of those, both the fees for using our facility, accessible, and we have ideas to even make it more accessible. It's a shame. We have a lot of the statistics on where the drop-off rates are, and it usually coincides with when fees start going up, even participation fees for high school. So we are going to be having a proposal later that tries to address some more of that. But the short answer to your question, our visitors, while we love to brag about the international aspect of it, 90% of our visitors are from Minnesota that use our facilities.
Thank you so much, and thank you for mentioning the vision of Governor Perpich, because it has made the difference. It has fulfilled the promise that the doubters at the time, in the 30 years ago, there was a lot of people that were doubting that this would be a good state investment, and now across the state, local communities are not doubting what the mission of just play can do for all families and kids in the state, as well as parents and grandparents. I mean, in our day, grandparents didn't follow the kids on every little hockey tour or soccer tour or softball tour or anything like that. And now the biggest group of people that are watching games are grandparents. And so we've made such a difference in the culture of the state. And I thank you for your contribution and what it's going to become as you work into your 30-year assignment. And Mr. Haverin, thank you. And maybe we'll see you on other world events on TV.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming and telling your story, because this indeed is a fine example of how state investment has encouraged people in Minnesota. And that's what we're for.
Thank you.
Thanks. Second item on the agenda is minutes.
Move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Sandstead moves that we adopt the minutes as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative. We do have a quorum. And the American Society of Engineers, we saw them in doing their work just before the session. We had volunteers, and now we can see something on the screen that we couldn't see before they volunteered. So let us We have a handout that Mr. Lee has created, because we are not the only ones that talk about transportation funding and what the responsibility of the state is in capital investments. The other committee has some responsibility too, and by the time we're done here today, all of us on this committee will know what our responsibility is and what representatives of the Transportation Committee will have. And we won't have to wonder anymore. We'll know that some bridges are ours and some aren't. Some roads are ours and some aren't. Some potholes are ours and some aren't. We're going to become so smart today. Some planes are ours and some aren't, and where they land. So, Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and members, I guess in your packet there's a one-page sheet that looks like this. It has a few road signs on it. This tries to break down the different areas of spending between the Transportation Finance and Policy Division and the Capital Investment Division, between roads, transit, and other transportation items. At the top, you can see the State Trunk Highway System. The Transportation Finance Division, I won't go through all of these, I'll just sort of hit the highlights, but the Transportation Finance and Policy Division oversees the day-in, day-out funding and operations and the vast bulk of the construction dollars for the trunk highway system. That's the state-owned roads that include U.S. interstate highways, U.S. highways, and Minnesota highways. The Capital Investment Committee, and you'll notice this a few times in the description of the capital investment funding areas, in the past has authorized trunk highway bonds and trunk highway cash. Unlike other committee areas, the capital investment bill does not contain base amounts, so every bill is, in a sense, a one-off amount, and it can spend $100 million on one type of project or program one year and spend nothing the next year. So unlike other bill areas, I have to use in the past because prior funding levels are no guarantee of continuing funding levels. Then I'll just also note that trunk highway bonds can only be used on the trunk highway system, and GO bonds can only be used on local road systems. And there's some interaction when you're dealing with projects that are interchanges or have components of both. But various bond council opinions over the years have said that GO bonds cannot be used on trunk highway projects and vice versa. Just a few other notes. The transportation bill area also allocates funding for the aid to local units of government for counties on the county state aid highway system and cities over 5,000 in population. There are cities that are under 5,000 in population, so these are incorporated places that do not receive state aid, but in the past there have been one-time appropriations for aid in the transportation bill area. In the bonding bill area for these local road systems, there have been supplemental appropriations, either for competitive grant programs where sort of over and above the formula-based aid that comes through the transportation bill area, the capital investment local road transportation programs funded through MnDOT have provided funding for usually specific projects like grade crossing separations, other railroad crossing or just simply road reconstruction projects. And in addition to MnDOT's local road and bridge programs, the Capital Investment Committee in the past has, in a number of occasions, specifically named local road projects to be done in the bill. Very briefly, transit, for the most part, the constitutionally dedicated and general fund direct appropriations for transit operations for both Greater Minnesota and the Metropolitan Council are in the transportation finance area, while in the past the capital investment bills have funded large capital projects. And also on passenger rail, there's an appropriation in the transportation bill area, and in the past, in the 2009 bonding bill, there was some GO bonds for that program. And then just some other areas. Ports have mostly only been funded out of capital investment bills, whereas railroads have kind of been split. There have been funding in the past in both transportation and bonding bills, sometimes with GO bonds and bonding bills, and sometimes with other fund spending. And with that, if members have any questions.
I guess not. But did it, the years that capital investments got involved, did they know in January or February that they would be involved with transportation projects, or did it come in May?
Madam Chair and members, in the past, there have been governor's recommendations specifically for bonding bills that requested that the bonding bill spend trunk highway dollars or use trunk highway bonds for specific projects that they didn't want in the transportation bill that the governor recommended. And, at times, things have showed up in, later in session in bonding bills.
And then the programs that the governor suggested, did they then they ended up in the capital investment bill for the most part?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I'm thinking back to a few occasions in 2011 and 12 in which the governor wanted the capital investment bill to spend trunk highway dollars. And the bonding bill for MnDOT facilities. So.
Oh, like the salt sheds and stuff? Okay. Keep that in mind as we're going along. So we'll have to be prepared. When it's suggested. And by whom? Any other questions? Representative Tarkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question as a comment. I know that transportation will be a hot topic this year again, and from a very variety of perspectives, one of the portions of the debate will be whether or not it's appropriate to use general fund dollars for transportation. I would just remind members of this committee that any time we use general obligation bonds for transportation projects, we are committing the general fund to service those bonds. And we've been doing it for many, many years, and I would guess there's a pretty good chance we'll be doing more of it again this biennium.
I accept your comment, and I'll ponder it for a while. But then you have the question of one-time money, too. But let's not go there when we have all these engineers before us that can clarify even more of what they have to present. And I understand it's Mr. Spihala?
Yes, madam.
Okay, and Mr. Turner?
Yes, madam.
Okay, so you're starting off, right?
Yes.
Go for it.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Seth Spihala, and I'm a professional engineer. I'm the legislative committee chair for the Minnesota section of the American Society of Civil Engineers. I am also a past president of the section. My colleagues and I are here to present to you, the committee, today the findings of the 2018 Minnesota Infrastructure Report Card.
And we have copies of that report card in our packets. I got mine at a local thing, and so it came all just flat, but yours is folded nice. And so whatever way you want. Let's please continue.
Thank you. The Minnesota section of ASCE is made up of over 1,700 men and women, volunteers in the engineering profession. Our section celebrated its centennial in 2014. Our members are the designers, constructors, operators, and maintainers of Minnesota's infrastructure, the backbone of our society, the built environment. The American Society of Civil Engineers represents more than 150,000 civil engineers in 177 countries. Founded in 1852, ASCE is the nation's oldest engineering society. ASCE is a nonprofit organization.
And it's paid for with dues of the members?
Yes, madam.
And is that dues from the members' personal costs to the member, or is it in, does the dues come out of the projects that the engineers receive?
So the dues are individual dues paid by the members. I will say that some firms do reimburse their employees to participate in the program.
So some of our local money might be going into dues of the members of this organization.
It could, yes. Some of the firms do pay for their employees to be part of ASCE.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Turner?
Oh.
Is it his turn?
No. We'll keep going. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. So the first ASCE national report card was released in 1998. The society releases a national report card every 4 years. In 2017, ASCE gave the nation's infrastructure an overall grade of D+. We started the Minnesota report card back in 2016. We have a chairman, Jason Stabell. We have 9 lead authors of the 9 categories, and we had 9 supporting members. We released our findings in October 2018, 18 months after we started. The 2018 Minnesota Infrastructure Report Card gives an overall GPA grade of C to Minnesota's infrastructure. And as Madam mentioned, you all have a report card. This is the executive summary pamphlet. And you'll notice that a grade of C is mediocre and requires attention.
What is the D then?
A D would be poor and at risk.
And a B?
A B is a good, adequate for now.
And an A?
Exceptional, fit for the future.
Is there any A's in our state?
We do not have any, currently have any A's in our state, of the 9 grades, or the 9 categories that we graded.
They're all C's?
There's a B in aviation and a D+. For roads.
Please continue.
Sure. So we graded we used eight criteria to grade the categories. They're based on capacity, condition, funding, future need, operation and maintenance, public safety, resilience, and innovation. And again, you can see the grades of the individual categories. And with that, I will turn it over to Nick for discussion on roads.
Mr. Turner, Representative Salk.
Thank you. Before you get too far down, you used a term a couple slides back. It was the top criteria. I was going to ask if that is capacity. Is that capacity of the road specific that was being looked at, or is it capacity of a system-wide condition?
Madam? Mr.
I'm sorry, Ms.
Mr. Spiegel?
Sure.
Representative, it depends on the category, the capacity, so each of the categories have different capacities, but Nick would be able to answer that specifically for roads if that's what you're interested in.
Mr. Turner?
Madam, yes, for the roadways, the congestion of the roadways was used for the capacity measurement.
Representative Salt?
Madam Chair, if you could just add to that just a bit, because I wasn't thinking of just roads or just what, because we have overall capacity of, and that's why I was asking the system, if that's talking about capacity of the system, meaning roads, rail, air, let's see, what else are we measuring here? To me, that's a system analysis as opposed to a specific analysis of you're standing or you're trying to rate Highway 52.
Mr. Turner.
Yes, Madam Chair. These eight criteria were used for the individual categories. So the roadway category considered the capacity of the roads. The aviation category considered the capacity of airports. The bridges considered the capacity of bridges. So they were considered separately. They, an overall system, as you're discussing, may not have been considered as part of our report card.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Continue, Mr. Turner.
Madam, thank you for the opportunity to testify before your committee. My name is Nick Turner. I am a licensed professional engineer here in the state of Minnesota, and my focus is in transportation design. My mission this morning is to articulate the condition and the funding needs for the public roads here in Minnesota. The American Society of Civil Engineers, the Minnesota chapter, has assigned a letter grade of a D-plus to the roads of Minnesota. And that is a poor grade, and what that depicts is that it requires immediate attention for Minnesota. So Minnesota has about 140,000 miles of roadway. This is not a measurement of lane miles. That's a measurement of the center lane miles, the actual miles of pavement here in our state. 140,000 miles, that's more than 50 trips from Los Angeles to New York, 50 trips all packed into our one state. Of these miles, 16% are considered urban, leaving around 116,000 miles of rural roads in Minnesota. So why is that breakdown important? I wanted to break down the difference between urban and rural roads for a safety comparison. On the 16% that are urban, Minnesota has a fatality rate of 0.29 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. On the rural roads, it's nearly a four times increase, up to a 1.12 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. Combined as a state, we're at 0.63, and compared to nationally, we are better than the national average of 1.16 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles. Why I wanted to bring that up, though, is that still means that in Minnesota, on roadways, we had 358 deaths occurred in 2017. So now let's talk about the condition of the roads. Of the 140,000 miles, 12,000 of them are state-owned trunk highway system. Currently, the Minnesota trunk highway system meets each of the MnDOT targets for the percent of poor roadways. I chose to show the poor rating on my slide today because when a road falls far enough to be labeled a poor rating, that's going to be when it will have to be fully reconstructed in order to have the pavement life return any form of usability. So these roads will require full reconstruction. MnDOT's 10-year projection shows these favorable conditions disappearing. The 10-year projection shows nearly five times more interstate miles will be poor, nearly four times more other national highway system miles will be poor, and more than two times more non-national highway system miles will be poor. In 10 years, we're expected to not meet MnDOT's targets for two of those three categories, the interstate and other national highway system roadway miles. Now let's talk congestion of the roads. When reviewing congestion levels in Minnesota, we not only found that the Twin Cities area is obviously some of the worst congestion in the state, but the Twin Cities area is recognized nationally for its congestion. The average driver losing 41 hours in traffic each year is costing the state about $2.3 billion of lost revenue. That's on the individual drivers. The average driver losing 41 hours costs the average driver about $1,332 per driver annually. That is considered to be the 17th worst urban area in the nation. We also found that the trucking industry has identified the Twin Cities as one of the top congestion areas for trucking as well. They identified 5 intersections in the Twin Cities, all which fall within the worst 100 bottlenecks in the country. The only 2 cities to have more than the 5 bottlenecks that we've identified are Houston and Atlanta. So now to talk about condition or funding. Every 4 years, MnDOT updates their 20-year Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan. Most recently, the report was released in January of 2017. This report showed that the projected investment over the next 20 years falls $17.7 billion short of the investment need. That leaves an $885 million funding gap annually. In 2013, the last time the same report was released, that annual gap was identified as $695 million. There's $190 million growth between those 4 years. If that same growth ends up showing up in the 2021 report, the annual funding gap will end up being measured in billions rather than millions for our state roadways.
Representative Pearson.
I'm assuming, Mr. Turner, these numbers are adjusted for inflation, or is this just a cost number? Because, of course, we know the costs have all gone up on all of these specific inputs as well, Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Madam, yes, I do believe that that is correct, that inflation is considered in this. Now about the maintenance of roads. So the roadway costs in our state are not solely about repairing and replacing the roads. Keeping roads clear and safe is also a priority. Maintenance crews work all winter long to keep the roads clear of ice and snow, and they work all summer long to keep the roads clear of debris from storms and accidents. These maintenance costs are also seeing a rise in prices. Salt prices alone have more than doubled since 2001. The demand on the maintenance crews has also increased. In 2010, an example is cable median barriers in Minnesota averaged more than 5 hits per mile annually. Those are repaired by the maintenance crews who are also repairing the roadways. At this time, that is concludes the end of the road segment. I will pass off to our next presenter.
Just a moment.
Yes.
Representative Wolgema.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Turner, when having conversations with colleagues and other stakeholders about that funding gap, one of the things I've heard some people say is that that gap isn't really what it looks like because there's room to cut inefficient spending and we can cut inefficiencies. Mr. Turner, in your experience, based on your knowledge, are there inefficiencies that could be cut to lower that gap, or do we really need to get serious about funding these infrastructure, our state's infrastructure, so that we can get these grades up?
Yes.
Mr. Turner.
Madam, specifically when it comes to the funding, we are referencing the Minnesota, the MNCHIP report produced by MnDOT. It is not something that I am overly familiar with, so I would have to say that I can't answer the efficiencies questions that you've asked.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Maybe when others come, if they do know, they can add something to help Mr. Wolgema. That will be helpful if you include it in your remarks.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Turner. So when we talk about Minnesota having the 5th most miles in roadways in the United States, is that have any per capita bearing, or are we just like 5th out of all the states?
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, that is just, there's no capita included. We have the 5th most roadways in our state compared to other states.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Turner. So could you get us the information with the other 4? Because I'd like to see what our per capita road miles are compared to other states.
And Mr. Turner, if you could also include a list of the roads where nobody drives on them. Mr. Turner.
Yes, Madam Chair, I can follow up with you regarding the four states ahead of us and also a list of the per capita miles as well.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I had a question on Representative Wolgamott had mentioned something that I did want to comment on as well. Of course, the Department of Transportation has acknowledged that they have the opportunities to create better efficiencies to those levels. So that's actually the department's number, is my understanding as well, that they acknowledge that there are some efficiencies that can be wrung out. But I did want to ask Mr. Turner a question as well, Madam Chair. You'd come up with a number for the fatalities on Minnesota roads. And I guess I just don't want the perception to be purely on just the actual infrastructure. But you know, do you have a breakdown of how those fatalities can be attributed? Because again, we know there are other influences, other factors in our state, even compared to other states, as it pertains to DUI fatalities or distracted driving fatalities. You know, can we point to a sub segment of those fatalities and say this is pretty clearly a infrastructure issue on these fatalities versus just the blanket number of fatalities in Minnesota roads, Madam Chair?
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, yes, the data that we provided of the 358 deaths on roads, it is not specifically infrastructure related. It does include all deaths that occurred on roads, pedestrians, bicyclists, DUI fatalities. We can provide the breakdown that we see as far as which ones are attributed specifically to infrastructure. It may be hard to understand that, but we can provide the breakdown as well.
Thank you, Representative Pearson.
Yeah, and even that, Madam Chair, is only helpful as it pertains to are we getting better? Are we getting worse? You know, in that subcategory, is our infrastructure improving? You know, it's one thing to say it's a D plus, but are we getting better? Because you know, if we're coming off of a solid F. And infrastructure, the fatalities on our road are clearly from infrastructure shortcomings, and we're coming from an F and we're moving up to a D plus. Well, then we're going in the right direction. Let's keep pushing and doing the right things. But you know, if we're coming from where we were at a B, which I don't think anyone would argue our infrastructure was at a B 10 years ago, right? And especially from an engineering standpoint, reducing fatalities or those types of things. So just want to be careful that we're not attributing some of these statistics to the wrong thing, but of course saving Minnesota lives and the towards zero deaths that MnDOT has always been working towards is I think what everyone in this room has the goals towards as well. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Thank you. Mr. Spihala?
Yes, if we could, we're going to transition to bridges.
We can.
Yes. And if I could make
Mr.
this one.
Olson.
Madam Chair, one quick comment on the previous question. This is our first report card that we've released. And like the national report card, we plan to release every 4 years, so we will have a better idea 4 years from now if our grades are sliding or if we are improving. So that might help answer the representative's questions.
Representative Considine.
Well, thank you, Chair Murphy.
We already transitioned,
maybe one of these gentlemen can answer my question. But first, two comments. First, Representative Pearson, I'm happy to hear that we're going to start looking at inflation as we're going forward and keeping that in mind when we're considering things like this. But back to Representative Wolgamott, last biennium, the DOT commissioner pledged to get 15% of more efficient, and by the end of the biennium, he had realized those numbers, but we are pretty close to where we can do on the efficiency end of it. My question it was the last testifier, but maybe one of you guys can answer it. A couple of years ago, was in Denmark, noticed what great shape their roads in, came back, talked to the public works director. I said, how come? And he said, well, we probably have the worst conditions outside of Canada and Siberia, much worse than the rest of the states. If you look at the polar vortex, it comes down and surrounds Minnesota. Is that your experience, or is that an accurate statement to say that in the lower 48 we have the worst conditions to work under than any of the other states?
I think...
Mr. Olson.
My apologies, Madam Chair. I think we do experience a lot of freeze-thaw cycles here in Minnesota, and that does raise havoc on both pavements and bridge structures as well. So it is a tough environment. I don't know that I could say it's the toughest in the 48, but it is a rugged environment. Walking outside today, I can testify to that.
Representative Hostine.
Thank you, Chair. I was kind of hoping that we could actually say that that was the case, that we'd be number one as far as the worst conditions.
Mr. Spihala.
Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Olson to do the bridge category.
All right. Mr. Olson, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Steve Olson. I am a licensed professional engineer with over 30 years of experience as a bridge engineer. I also am a past president of the Minnesota section. My task is to articulate our bridge needs and funding needs for public bridges in Minnesota. The event locked into most Minnesotans' mind is the 35W collapse from 11 years ago. We have a lot of bridges in our state, nearly 20,000. About 5.4% of those are in poor condition. We ended up assessing the bridge category and giving it a grade of a C, and that C is significantly above the road grade, and that in part is due to the Chapter 152 funding provided for the bridge category.
And 152 funding is what?
There was a
Minnesota chapter?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Assembly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Olson, can you have a point on here on the slide. Can you tell us which of the interchanges in the Twin Cities that you have identified to need for improvement?
I think the 35W-494 interchange is one of those. I believe the interchange between 694, 494, and 94 on the east side of town as well are a couple of them that come to mind.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Wilson.
If we look at our population of bridges in Minnesota, we have roughly 88 million square feet of bridge deck area. It's a measurement used for funding. It's simply the length of a bridge multiplied by its width. 88 million square feet doesn't mean much to most people. If you think about 3.1 square miles of bridge deck, that might mean a little bit more. If you think of 50 U.S. Bank stadiums stacked together, that's how much bridge deck area we have in the state of Minnesota, and they are not shiny new stadiums. They have an average age of about 30 years old. As part of our report card, we looked at three different categories of bridges. We looked at the state system, the local system, and parks and trails. There are hundreds of bridges in each of these categories. With respect to the state system, it, as mentioned earlier, it's the interstates, the U.S. routes, the Minnesota Trunk Highways. The interstate routes are coming to the end of their service life. About 80 bridges a year at $2 million apiece is the estimated need for the state system.
Mr. Olson, are all the bridges that you're talking about designed and by licensed engineers?
Madam Chair, yes.
Go ahead, clarify. Please continue.
And I should note here that on our need for the state system, this $160 million per year is less than what the Chapter 152 program provided. That provided roughly $200 million a year for bridges. On the local system, we've identified needs of roughly $100 million per year needed. It can range from relatively large structures such as the 10th Avenue Bridge shown on the left, to more modest structures out in Wilkin County, which you see on the right, where the county engineers had to use some resourcefulness to hold the bridge embankments up. Typically, funding levels have been about at a $60 million per year level on the local system. The third category we looked at were parks and trails, and this is sort of the orphan bridge category, if you will. On the left, you'll see the Black Duck Bridge up in northern Minnesota. It's been damaged due to an arson event. Has been left damaged for several years now. On the right, you see the Jay Cook State Park Swinging Bridge that was damaged in the floods in northeast Minnesota several years ago. That bridge has been repaired. And just to wrap up relatively quickly here, I have several colleagues with good stories to tell you as well. So in a nutshell, funding needs, we see a need for $160 million per year on the state system. People have identified roughly $100 million per year for that system for the next few years. On the local system, we see needs of $100 million per year. $60 million has typically been provided. Last year was a relatively small year. I believe less than $15 million was provided for the local system last year. And we believe $10 million should be provided for the parks and trail system that has no identified funding at this point in time. And on the right is a graphic that basically says we've got 1,400 vehicular bridges in Minnesota that are eligible for federal funding. And so with 1,400 bridges needing work, it's hard to give it a grade above a C.
But you'll try.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative South.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point on bridges, we happen to be in a circumstance where a different issue is brought to light. We have a concrete color bridge where the joints and the plates are failing, so we had to reduce the bridge by a lane on each side just to let it continue to operate safely. And it's a major artery bridge in our city. Which brings to mind to me is, I understand what you did is you did a trajectory of failure from systems that exist, but isn't there also a stacking effect when there's something like this where either the engineering assumptions of building a bridge that way are failing, or in this case I think is more likely is that something in that particular bridge didn't get assembled well, and now it is going to fail early, and we're ending up losing capacity while we wait for that to be replaced.
Mr. Olson.
I think as engineers, we try to design for 50 or 75-year design lives, and I think the bridge in St. Paul is the one you're probably referencing. There was probably a change in understanding on how certain elements should be designed, and that led to a need to restrict traffic on that bridge. And so the estimates we have for numbers here do not anticipate uncovering events such as the one in St. Paul, I guess.
Just for your clarification, that's a Rochester bridge. Oh. It's unfortunate that by my description, we also were able to replicate possible examples around the state. So that leads to my point of that the question was is that we'll end up with a stacking of need that we may not yet realize, to your point.
Okay.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Olson. excuse me. This may be along those same lines. I'm assuming that designing of bridges today are very different than they were 30, 40 years ago, and the level of design, the redundancies, and all those things has changed. If you could just speak to that. Relative to how bridge design has evolved over time.
Mr. Olson.
Madam Chair, when the original specs were put together in the 1920s for bridge designers to start, it was roughly a 30-page document tacked on to the construction specs. In the 1960s, there was a collapse in Ohio, the Silver Bridge, which led to the National Bridge Inspection Program, the Fracture Critical Program, and those events continue to add to the requirements and things we considered during design. Today we have a stack of design manuals we need to look through that is at least this thick. And so we try to keep learning and getting better, but we still have more to learn.
Representative Pearson.
Well, I just could not take this opportunity to recognize the opportunity we have in this committee with another chair in the room that potentially, especially as it comes to parks and trails and the bridges and the shortcomings that usually go through the bonding dollars, I think there might be an opportunity in the legacy bill for perhaps a legacy Lilly Bridge amendment within the legacy bill, because those dollars would definitely be a fair use of these for these specific needs.
However, there's constitutional boundaries in the legacy bill.
We would certainly have to recognize that. We would certainly recognize that, but I think there's opportunities here for the requests and historical preservation. That some of this stuff, especially on the historical preservation or adaptive reuse, would be beyond that and fall certainly within those limits. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly will take your advice and make a muddle about it for a while. Please continue. We are now into 3 minutes for the remaining. Experts to come before us. Mr. Spihala, the next person.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to bring up Darwin Yazzie, and he will do the transit piece of the report card.
Okay, Mr. Yassis, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Darwin Yassis, and I'm the lead author for the ASC report card on transit, and I would like to share with you the infrastructure status right now on transit in Minnesota. So I think right now Minnesota has 5.7 million in population in 2017. 3.6 million of those population reside within the Twin Cities metro area. And as a general recap, right now, annually, there are 111 million rides in Minnesota delivered through public transit, and 99 million is in the metro area, and 12 million of that is within the outstate greater Minnesota area. The transportation systems comes in different forms, but I think most of us are very familiar with the forms of services that public transit provides, so in the form of light rail transit, for example, buses, and some of those on-demand metro mobility vans, if you may. 43 systems in greater Minnesota and 7 systems within the metro area. So within the metro area, metro transit, basically, the ridership is over 80% statewide. So metro transit pretty much covers a lot of these ridership. And as part of our report, in essence, transit got a C-minus. $450 million is needed over the next 5 years, and $5 billion over the next 20 years. And I think I'll expand on that one a little bit as we move forward with the presentation. As I've said earlier, so $111 million, and if you look down on the page here, so Met Council bus, $64 million. So that's a massive amount of ridership in terms of being provided for the population. This is a quick snapshot of the transit operating budget, $89 million for the greater Minnesota. And if you move the other slide, about $511 million within the Twin Cities metro area. So this chart right here basically just shows us the operational cost with that increasing demand that we've been seeing. In fact, right now I'd like to just identify that 1.6% overall growth across the systems happened between 2010 and 2015. It was also the fourth largest growth rate in ridership between 2005 and 2015 compared to all our peer cities, say including Baltimore, Maryland, Seattle, Portland, and other cities of our density So we are comparing basically ourselves within those peer cities to be able to identify whether we are at a certain efficiency rate in terms of operational costs. And again, going back, this is just a pretty much a trajectory of the need for the transit system. I have given you some basic facts regarding the ridership. In fact, we've hit ridership numerous times in terms of record highs. In 2015, for example, Metro Transit had that record high of 12 million rides and 1.24 million hours of service. So in terms of the demand is definitely out there. And I think if everyone is familiar, the light rail transit, for example, the blue line together with the green line pretty much exceeded the capacity within the first 2 years of operations, where the projections were 15 years to make it a little bit more conservative. But yeah, I guess within the first second year of operations, we've already hit the demand. So it's just a pretty much an observation from our research that the demand is already out there once we are providing these transit services to the population.
Mr. Yeses, are there any pockets in the state where no one has, where there are no transit available to the population?
Madam Chair, the good news is, I think, within the 80 counties of Greater Minnesota, we currently have transit public transit service. There's also a growing demand within the Greater Minnesota area, so that's why I think we are also identifying those needs. So good news is, yes, we have public transit for all the counties within Minnesota.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following along that line, can you give us a breakdown of the $450 million? How much is it needed for the metro area, and how much is needed for Greater Minnesota Transit?
I think if you look, so the metro area, I think definitely we're talking in the billion dollars, and generally because of the population. So if you look at the population between the Twin Cities metro area versus the outstate, there's a big disparity there, but there's also a big density change, shall we say, or delta. So within the metro area, definitely I think the breakdown would have to be a series of the buses, the light rail transit, and at the same time right now, if you're seeing some of the bus rapid transit, for example, I think we've been asked whether we presented the needs for bridges and roadways, and that was also a concern when we started looking at these, because definitely as a system, as a whole overall transportation system, they need to gel together. We are not supposed to be looking at purely transit for transit use, but be able to alleviate congestion and alleviate some of those needs for the bridges that are going through some of our systems to be able to make our systems work.
Representative Pearson.
Madam Chair, thank you for the, and it's actually just a request that we get these emailed to us. The projections aren't, I can't actually read much of the projections on the screen, and the copies didn't come through very well. Mr. Yeses gave us a pretty good description of what I think we're looking at, but especially when it comes to the some of the ridership and projections, prior projections and where we're actually at, that's, I think, extremely important not only to this committee but to all Minnesotans.
Correct. Representative Salt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point also, I think when this was introduced, I think you used the description of executive summary, which then the following assumption would be that there is a much fuller report that would go into higher level of detail, and maybe some of the elements that Representative Pearson was also asking about is that there's more answer to the questions, I think, in the next layer of your report interpretation.
Yes, Madam Chair? The quick answer to that is yes. So all the data is basically incorporated in our, the study. here that shows all the statistics behind the executive summary.
And Mr. Spihala, is that available to us or at the library, at the legislative library, or is that available someplace?
Madam Chair, it is available online. So we do, to your point, there is an 82-page document that backs up the executive summary. The URL address is listed in the pamphlet. So if you go to www.infrastructurereportcard.org/Minnesota, you can get the full report. And it is listed here in the pamphlet.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Pearson, for making us all aware of now how we can get to the real language in the study online. Thank you very much. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. One of the areas, though, I think we're going to need to work on for transit, I've had an advocate, I believe, from your district, Representative Torkelson. She lives right outside of Windham. Tell me that to get to the Capitol, it's, I believe, 4 hours for her, and it costs her $135 to do so. So, effectively, it's not there for her.
Thank you.
It's not your district?
Sorry.
Mr. Spihala?
Madam Chair, I would like to call Michael Monroe up to discuss aviation.
This is our best grade.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Manor. I am the lead author of the aviation category, a member of ASCE, and I did receive my pilot license certificate in 2003, fulfilling a lifelong dream that I had since I was 5 years old. So when I was asked to come and try to help out with this entire report card, it was kind of a surreal experience. It was one area where we had nobody to take lead on that, so the effort put in this was unique in that aspect. The
you're not saying our best grade was because of that.
No, Madam Chair. No, it was a challenging effort just in gathering the data and information and the time and resources that we had to put into this. But I will go through this relatively quickly out of respect for the rest of our peers and the other categories. So we looked at the state of Minnesota. We have 134 state-funded airports. We had 135, if I'm understanding correctly, is been dropped to 134 because of the situation in Silver Bay, Minnesota, which I believe is
temporarily.
Out of these 134 state-funded airports, we have 9 commercial. That's Minneapolis-St. Paul, Rochester, St. Cloud Regional, Brainerd, Duluth International, Hibbing, Bemidji, Falls International or International Falls, and Thief River Falls. The MAC airport system is made up of 7, including MSP and the 6 relievers, Anoka County, Blaine, Flying Cloud, Crystal, Air Lake, St. Paul Downtown, and Lake Elmo. On the next slide, I'll go through the capacity very quickly. When we looked at this, we were trying to balance capacities from the greater Minnesota. We'll cover a different conversation in the next slide, but for the purposes of MSP, we look at 98% of our commercial passengers going through Minneapolis-St. Paul compared to and the balance of that going through the other commercial airports in the state. Based on the numbers that we're looking at, Minneapolis-St. Paul did hit a record in 2017. I'm not sure what the numbers are for 2018 as far as total passengers, but when you look at the profiles here, the passengers have gone up, while at the same time the operations, the actual number of aircraft taking off and landing from Minneapolis-St. Paul have kind of stabilized, at least for now. In a nutshell, the terminals look good until 2025. We were looking at their long-term strategic plans, and the forecasts of 511,000 operations per year, that's 511,000 takeoffs and landings, up to, I think, 2035 is going to be below their peak that they experienced in 2004. In contrast, when I was talking with folks, when we look at Greater Minnesota, it's not so much capacity conversation as it is about accessibility. We have five airports of Greater Minnesota that are eligible under the Essential Air Service Program. As of the 2016 FAA's indicators, these are the five that we have. Contrastingly, the numbers of passengers in Greater Minnesota compared to Minneapolis-St. Paul is hardly a comparison. However, we've had an interesting observation in Rochester and how they're trying to get the community excited and more involved in an awareness of the use of their local airport and taking, instead of driving to Minneapolis-St. Paul, actually leveraging their asset locally. And as of 2017, Rochester surpassed Duluth, and I believe the numbers in 2018, I just did a quick check last night online, and the numbers from 2017 to 2018 increased another 26% in travelers leaving out of Rochester. So I make that point primarily to indicate there's a theme that came across in our review that think locally, have the conversation locally, work together locally, and that can drive certain results. So moving on, the last part on this slide, there is a related issue that came out of this, and I did reference a source in here. It's a report of the Working Group on Improving Air Service in Small Communities. It's published in 2017 through USDOT, and I encourage folks to take a look at that. And it has to do, in part, it's not just about the EAS program and making sure there's funding for that, but there's a growing issue of pilots and available pilots and how the major air carriers are becoming in a position to start pulling from regional carriers and such. We also have declines in the number of young people wanting to become pilots. We have retiring older pilots. So I won't get into the weeds with this right now, but it is something that has a direct impact on this, and everybody came out in that report. So next slide, please. From a condition standpoint, we had as much of the data as we could compile on pavement. Things look pretty good statewide, and I look at this slide, and it reminds me of the initial meeting we had with Minnesota DOT leadership, just presenting where ASC was going with this report card and such, and when we came to this conversation of airports, I was asked specifically to make sure that we don't just look at pavements and how new the terminals are. So I hope the spirit of that, our response, serves that request. The terminals are reasonably in good condition. There was a lot of investment done from 2009 on. I think International Falls 2017-2018, received a considerable upgrade in their terminals up there. So in the context of our ability to review, they look pretty good. The next slide. I not only looked at maintenance and operations, we threw sustainability into this for the purpose of the conversation this morning. When we looked at the terminals, and especially not just Minneapolis-St. Paul, but every place that there's been investment, there is a spirit of sustainability, a clear mindset present in investment in design and utilization of other resources as opposed to just fossil fuel heating and cooling, things like that. And this is just a sample of this. From lighting, the intent there was to mention efficiency lightings that have been put into place, for example, at Minneapolis-St. Paul in their new parking ramps and such. The other point in this, from a financial sustainability, this was an interesting note that came out. Minneapolis-St. Paul's cost per passengers is around $6.50 as compared to our other major hubs across the country. I thought that stood out quite impressively. Next slide.
That's a huge difference.
It's a very big difference, and I think Max should be applauded for that. The next slides, we'll go through these relatively quickly. We took a look at the MnDOT Aviation Division Project List Report that was published in 2017. That's what we had available at the time. To go through, we went through each and every airport, and we took a band of time, 2018 to 2022, and looked at the CIP outlook and compiled all of that, and I use the term estimate because these were forecast numbers. We're averaging about $96 million per year for this is non-MAC related airports or Greater Minnesota related airports, and that's as good a number as I have right now. In our conversations when going through this, I wanted to call out, and I'll go through this in our overall summaries, the use of what they call needs meetings that the director of MnDOT Aeronautics is going through. And I'll touch on that a little bit later, but I think that's going to be a compelling conversation going forward. The State Airport Fund, we looked at those monies, and I understand as of fiscal year 2018, their number was $24.9 million. We averaged the number of 2010 through 2017, the state or the FAA AIP funding that comes into these our airports, about $48 million a year on average. MnDOT did make a difference in 2015 of shifting a greater burden of that 10% traditional 10% match of local organizations to the DOT, and that has affected a change in the increase in demand. Next slide, Metropolitan Airports Commission. These are high-level numbers. We looked at all costs. This is just an overview breakdown, looking at their future costs of $884 million per year. That number, I believe, includes $250 million per year for MSP and the relievers, and looking at their all of their receipts. The long and short of this slide is when we look at Minneapolis-St. Paul and how they're running their operations, things look pretty good, at least in the near term. So go to the last slide, and I'll conclude. I won't go through all of these bullets. I highlighted the bottom two as far as items that we feel we can act on locally. One would be a simple means of sharing statewide CIP needs amongst all of the leadership of the different airports and governing bodies in those airports. And the last thing would be to reinforce what MnDOT is doing with their needs meetings. In those needs meetings, very quickly, they don't just send the director. They send a director, deputy director, a planner, an engineer, and a pilot, I believe, to these airports and really expand the conversation amongst the community. So I went through that pretty quickly, maybe, Madam Chair.
Yes. And I think we have responses from the committee, but we can't have them or questions at this time. Mr. Spihala, could we do Mr. Bursch because he came from so far?
Yes, Madam Chair.
On this cold day. And he represents the ports, which covers five cities, or four at least for sure. Right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Craig Bursch. I'm a licensed professional civil engineer from Duluth, Minnesota. Nice to see a familiar face here today, Madam Chair.
I am and a friendly.
Yes, and a friendly face. I'm a past president of the Duluth section of ASCE and the current government relations chair. And in the interests of brevity, I'll keep these comments fairly brief. So we got a C-plus in ports, which is a fairly good grade. This is one of the better grades that we got. From this slide, the takeaway I'd like you to have, I know you've seen a lot of facts and figures today, about 80% of the tonnage moves through the ports on Lake Superior. About 20% of the tonnage moves through our river ports. So just to give you a bit of perspective, for the Port of Duluth alone, that represents about 900 vessel visits. So the lift bridge goes up and down 900 times. And it supports nearly 8,000 jobs with an economic impact of about $1.4 billion. So our ports are multimodal economic drivers for the communities that they serve. Without drilling too deeply into the weeds, our C-plus grade matches the national C-plus grade for ports. So we're about on par with the rest of the country. Neither good, neither bad, just a data point for consideration. We're doing pretty well there, but there is room for improvement. Generally, capacity at our ports was not an issue. We have quite a few docks that have product flexibility, which means they can offload or onload different things. They're not restricted to just one item. Although a significant portion of the docks are at or have exceeded their design service life. So getting near to the point where they need attention, upgrades, et cetera, to move forward. We've had success recently with federal grants, especially in Duluth. A recent Tiger grant was used for corrosion protection projects and development of some berths, security upgrades at some private docks. And then we've seen more money federally from the Corps of Engineers and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative to address dredging backlog. So we've had some success with funding at the federal level. An emerging issue of concern for a lot of executive directors at ports is gentrification, where the general public doesn't perhaps see the port as an asset, a transportation asset, and the industrial clients that they serve. They see it as an eyesore that needs to be upgraded by something else, more commercial. Neither here nor there, just a concern that's out in with executive directors at ports and something to keep in mind as we go forward about preserving these assets. My friend Deb DeLuca, who is the executive director at the Duluth Port Authority, asked me to include this photograph. She thinks it's a great one illustrating that a port isn't a port without great roads and rail. Ships come in and they get offloaded, but that cargo has to go somewhere. It goes out on a rail, it goes out on a road. Yeah, these are wind turbine components going onto a truck. And vice versa, cargo comes into the port to get put onto a ship, but it has to come on via rail or via truck. And the idea to think about this, you've heard it mentioned before, as a system. This is a multimodal piece of infrastructure. There's more than one component that goes into it. And sometimes it's interrelated that a port is looking for an upgrade for a rail or a road. And you say, well, why would a port look for an upgrade on a rail or a road? It's because that first mile in and out of the port is critical to the port. So after all these facts and figures today, I know you're sitting on the edge of your seat saying, Craig, how can I help raise this grade? The good news is we have a funding mechanism here in the state of Minnesota, the Port Development Assistance Program. The last go-around, the ports in the state identified needs of about $34 million. About $5 million was awarded. So certainly expansion of the dollars available in this program would be helpful. In the state of Minnesota, only public docks are allowed to apply for grants. If the program and funding could be expanded for grant access for private dock owners to allow them to do some security upgrades, that would also be helpful. Private dock. Private dock. If we go back. If you take a look at the photo, some of these docks belong to the Port Authority. Some belong to private industries. So where a ship comes in and offloads its cargo, for instance. They're not a hubbub of foot traffic. It's not that someone gets up in the morning and accidentally walks down to go to a dock. But a lot of these docks have no more security than just a placard on a sign that says, please don't fall off into the water. So even installation of a chain link fence would help with public safety at a private dock.
Could you, before we end, could you name the ports that we're talking about?
Absolutely.
Besides Duluth, Southern Minnesota has a couple. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Minnesota.
Two Harbors, Port of St. Paul, Silver Bay, Port of Savage, Port of Winona, Port of Red Wing, and then a small private one, Taconite Harbor, which is also on Lake Superior, Madam Chair. And that's the end of my prepared remarks. I'll be happy to take any questions from the committee or the chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for mentioning intermodal activity here in the state. I think it's very important to our economic future, and the ports, of course, are kind of the hub of some of that intermodal activity. But also thank you for mentioning railroads. Railroads didn't get a grade in your report. I assume that's because they would have gotten an A. Because at least for the Class One railroads, they've already invested quite heavily in the state of Minnesota, upgrading their tracks. And I, for one, would like to see our short lines be able to do the same thing. And any comments on railroads?
Mr. Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Torkelson. This is the first time our committee has done a statewide report card. That will be a category that we will be adding in the future. For the first go around, we assembled our coalition of the willing and went forward, but that has been noted as a deficiency by others as well, including Congressman Nolan at our release event in Duluth back last March. As for rails, I'm not an expert in that category, but I believe we may have some other colleagues that could follow up with you on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Spihala?
Madam Chair, I'll also mention that in the national report card, rail typically gets a better grade. There are a lot of rails that are private, and they have seen the investment in their infrastructure, and the grade bolsters that.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Spihala, and all the testifiers today. Thank you for coming and speaking. I'll just note that I hope that the engineering profession is evolving. You're all a bunch of white men that presented to us today, and I hope we'll see more women and more people of color in the future. Thank you.
We had a woman on the list, but we're going to let her come back.
Okay. Well, on that note, Madam Chair, one out of eight is still only 12.5%.
And they're going to take that under consideration, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned and will be continued on Tuesday. Ms. Erickson, is that correct? On Tuesday. First thing, but not for too long. So, thank you very much. I'm sorry we're over. This meeting is adjourned.